I'm Vern Fayetta, and we are doing the third in the series of studies of stories in Luke called New Beginnings, and this is number three, which is a study of Luke 7, 36 to 50, called Tender Mercies, and it's the story of the woman with ointment. I want to recap some of my general concerns about how we use the Bible. I'm concerned about our owning and accepting responsibility for our use of the Bible. I think that our particular tradition is in a stage of becoming more self-conscious about our social responsibility and our place as a church, not as an immigrant church, but really as an American church and as a part of the whole world. And I think that also means that we need to think more carefully about responsible use of the Bible. One of the most important things in accepting responsibility for our use of the Bible, and you notice I'm really shifting the question from whether the Bible is true or good or bad to the question of whether we are using. I assume that the Bible has lived a long time and done God's work in the world. That's pretty clear historically. I don't know why people argue about that. I think the real question is whether we are using the Bible in a way that nurtures us and nurtures our church. Now, one of the hidden questions that is absolutely key in becoming responsible is, why did you pick that text? Why did you pick that text? Because when all is said and done, we are the people that open the Bible and pick a text. Even if we choose to roll the dice or do it randomly, we are choosing to do it randomly rather than asking someone who knows a lot about the Bible or looking in a concordance or doing it some other way. And so when all is said, and the Bible is, after all, the story, the long story of God's people. And David becomes king of Israel in 1000 BC, and the book of John is after 90 AD, so we're talking about a minimum of 1100 years. And some of the stuff in the early sections of the Bible, there are stories that have been handed down from much earlier periods than that, 1200, 1300, things like that. So you see, we're talking about an almost 1500 year span of time. And the God story changed. It had lots of episodes. They're not just doing the same episode over and over again. Can you imagine a TV show that ran for 1500 years? Can you imagine a life cycle story? This is a big story. And the Bible is not an answer. The Bible is 100 answers to every question you've got. You've got tons of examples of what people did with a problem. I mean, even in the New Testament, you don't have one Jesus, you've got four Jesuses, at least. Matthew, Mark, and Luke just didn't look at Jesus with the same eyes. You know, and if you start paying attention to the Bible, you got more answers than you know what to do with. So that, so we are the people that have to decide, do we go to Amos? Do I pick this text? Do I pick that text? Do I pick Luke rather than John? You decide when you open your Bible. And so that this whole business of being owning the fact that we choose the text. We choose a text to loosen things up, or we choose a text to close things down. We choose a text that's about spirit. I mean, when Paul writes to Galatians, he's got people who are too uptight. And so he blasts them on freedom. And when he writes to Corinthians, he's got people who are so loose that the place is falling apart, and he's trying to get them to be more more coherent in their loving. Why, that's just, the one is practically the opposite from each other. Why? Because Galatians was a totally different place than Corinthians. They're two different congregations. They weren't written by the same congregation at all. So why do you pick Galatians and why do you pick Corinthians? You know, are you trying to loosen things up or you're trying to close things down? You see what I'm saying? We are the ones that pick the text. And so it's terribly, terribly important that we own the fact, that we acknowledge that we are the ones that have made these choices and that we learn to make them intelligently, responsibly. So that's why, for example, one of my fun illustrations is I realized after I've had some relatives and some friends who are really fine, substantial, normal, in every way, just like I am, people, and they happen to be gay or lesbian. And so I'm really concerned about the degree to which non-gays or lesbians use that designation to project their problems on other people. I'm convinced that when we see people as other, we are really projecting onto them things that we are denying and haven't dealt with fully in ourselves. And so this really concerns me a lot. So, you know, and then I've discovered something extremely interesting. Most of the time when there are anti-gay articles in our college newspaper, they quote Leviticus about homosexuality. And then I discovered something else, you know. Jesus quotes Leviticus as a very important pillar of his ministry. Do you know what verse from Leviticus Jesus quotes? And you all know it, you all use it. Which one?
Love your neighbor.
It's two chapters away from the anti-gay text, from the anti-homosexual text. Now, so the question is, why did Jesus pick the love your neighbor text rather than all those? I mean, and nobody quotes the other half of the anti-gay, you know, anti-homosexual text, which is if you got homosexuals or adulterers or whatever people, stone them. Nobody quotes that. There is nobody that I know, even the most conservative Christian, who takes every verse in the Bible and acts on it. There just isn't anybody. There just isn't anybody, or they land in a mental institution. Or they get put, you know, they'd go around killing people if they did all of that. I can show you some really terrible texts, but, you know, we don't choose those most of the time, and you certainly never preach on them. So, of course, people don't own those texts as part of the Bible. You see, part of the process of having a Bible, it's like having a kid. God gave you something that's really big and important and wonderful, or like having a parent. Gave you something that's really big and important and wonderful, but you got to figure out what to do with them. You can't be them. And a community that's living in the Spirit cannot be a first century community, but it can learn and be nurtured and be inspired by first century community. So, you know, you get the drift of the thing. So I'm into owning. And the other thing I want to say, I think those of you, there are not many people left anymore that are really into systematically discovering what's in the Bible. There just aren't very many people that do that anymore. And I think it's partly because some of the old styles of Bible study have squeezed too many people to kind of asphyxiate them, and not many people hang in till they learn how to read the Bible for themselves. But you see, that's terribly important, because the time to prepare yourself for using texts is before there's any need to use them. The time to prepare a congregation for being integrated is before there are any blacks in the neighborhood, before they're defensive, you see. the time to make your decisions about what you're going to do when you, at a certain stage of your life, are before you have to do it. You make your will before you're on your deathbed. Because when the crisis is there, you got to act, you can't think. And so it's very, very important to have enough of a repertoire of Bible kind of at your fingertips and in your bones so that you have some resources. That was the great value of learning, memorizing Bible verses in confirmation. I still have some of the Bible verses I learned in confirmation. I still have some of the Bible stories I learned in kindergarten, in Sunday school. So this whole business of keeping on unpacking text, almost everybody I run into that has a serious Christian question, I think to myself, gee whiz, I wish you knew more Bible. Because you could see some answers to that, you could see some different answers to that question. Most of the time when we're in a log jam, it's because we can't imagine other answers to the question. And usually there are five answers to every question. You know, just five answers or more. Not all the answers are good answers, but probably there's three or four good answers to every question. And so it makes quite a lot of difference whether you take one of those three, whether you take the other 10, which are lousy answers to the question. But of those three, it doesn't make so much difference. But you get the drift of this line of conversation. It's really important to store up. And so I want to confirm and affirm and say you're on the right track. Those of you who keep reading the Bible story by story, just spend enough time with each story that you kind of make it, bring it, let it come to life again. Because the big thing that happens is aborted stories. You just read them quickly and somebody else tells you what you mean, what they mean, and you haven't let them percolate around in your own consciousness and become, sort of find its own interfacing with your story. That's why I really like the old discipline of, you know, get a story a day and maybe 15 minutes of kind of centering down and thinking about the story, and then you start thinking about the people you need to think about. And I like, that's still a really healthy way to carry on life. To carry on life and to keep yourself kind of open, keep all the windows open so you don't just, because it's very interesting, there's a wonderful line, when you become older, you become more like you are. And so what you do now is what you, and it's very interesting. It's very interesting. Both my spouse and I, we're paying attention to how our parents are aging. And we're very fortunate. Several of our parents have aged very cleverly, very gracefully. And they're just bright and clear and they know what's going on. And their life is simpler than it used to be. But they're right in the middle of it. They're every minute of their life is still life, full, rich life, and it's the same life they've been living. You know. So anyhow. Okay. So Luke Acts. That's my concern, which I've been calling in general responsible exegesis. Then the themes in Luke Acts, recap them. Spirit, remember, and notice the variety of images of God in the Bible. Again, which image do you use? Luke was not big on the Father image. I mean, John was big on Father-Son talk. But Luke isn't so big on Father-Son talk. Luke is big on Spirit. When all is said and done, what makes the story flow in Luke is that the Spirit baptizes Jesus, the Spirit baptizes the community with sparks. Sparks, will you please? That's what Spirit's all about. Inspiration, breath, life, wind. Spirit is always, spirit is not like a person, spirit is like when the wind blows. And it comes from Lord knows where and it goes Lord knows where, but you feel it. You feel it. And so God, so this is the image. This is the image that is important for Luke, the spirit image. And there are little traces of mother images in Luke, and there's a hen image in one of the prophets about the Lord holding you under your under wings. We had a dog image in Matins this morning. Some are more primal than others, fine, but just, oh goodness, you know, you gotta have a little imagination. Or you can't relate to the things that are deep and real and permanent in life. And so, you know, just, it's okay to let the imagination go. So spirit and journey, we had that same image used this morning, also by Preisinger in the pilgrim image, you know. That's one of the things I always come home from Holden with, is that's why I walk up the valley, because I keep recovering the sense of my life as a journey. And I am therefore a pilgrim. I move from here to here to here. What's the line? We have no continuing city. So that, some of us live a long time, but not very long either. So that we are always moving along. Today is not yesterday, and tomorrow is not today, and this is koinonia, and that's the hike house, and then it's the bridge, and then it's the wilderness, and then it's the trail sign, and then it's Heart Lake, and then it's Cloudy Pass. We move along. And so journey is big. They're always in process from Jerusalem to Rome, and I cannot understand. One of the things that I weep about kind of inside is, why does the church lose the sense of being on a journey? Why aren't we always on the way to someplace? To the city, to being inclusive, to Jerusalem, to Africa, to the moon, if you please. You know, we are a journey. We're on a journey. As though God was high-tech and fixed, and not someone who moves with the ongoing movement of our history. Okay, journey. Okay, and the ups and downs of being on that journey. And Luke is full of all different kinds of stories, and they're very different. So into today's story, and you remember that I'm into the action, plot is basic, the clues in, then we share the clues that make for the conversations and that we have to have with ourselves and with each other. And then gestures. Since stories are about actions, they deserve a gesture. And I've been teaching a long time, and I'm pretty sure that unless somebody does something with what you tell them, it just waters the plants, but it doesn't become part of what they do. so that it's very important to make a gesture. Say, this is one I've got to spend half an hour thinking about. This is one I'm going to reflect about. This is, maybe there's somebody's feet that you need to wash, given this text. Who knows? Maybe you need to wash your own feet. Maybe it's time to take a bath. Do something that honors that there's some energy and action in this text. Because otherwise what we're doing is we're making these texts into videos that you use to tune out, and then you just use them like the taking a hot shower. You use them to relax, but you don't do anything with them. Well, these are seeds. Most of these are good for sprouts or at least they're good for sprinkling the plants. And you see what I'm saying? So try to figure out a gesture as you leave that has something to do with the text. Jot something down, just. So this is the, you see how I've really got a theory here, a model, a little theory here that I'm sort of slipping into alongside of these really good stories. I mean, it's really about the stories, but I want to slip in a little theory because you are all bright adult people, so you can do this for yourself. You can do this for yourself if you get the questions straight and you get the moves right. Go home and do it. It's that simple. Okay. Stories. So we got to get into the action and context, and I think the action is the important part. And then to get the context, I guess the simplest way is to just look at the characters in the characters. Fill in something about the characters in this story. One of the Pharisees. Okay, let's kind of zip strip the Pharisee image. Okay, you need to know a couple things about Pharisees that some of you. This is Karen Coles to Newcastle, but. Well, maybe I should start the course. Who are the Pharisees? What do you know about Pharisees?
They're leaders, church leaders.
They are leaders. Can I edit for you, Nick? Let's, when we talk about Jews, talk about synagogue, not church. Church is a peculiarly Christian word. Everybody has congregations. Jews have congregations. Muslims have congregations. Christians have congregations. But only Christians have churches, only Jews have synagogues, only Muslims have mosques. And so if we're going to be respectful of each other, I don't mind your calling the synagogue a church, but a Jew wouldn't care for your making him into a Christian when he really doesn't want to be. So we got to be a little bit, I can think in my heart they're sort of premature Christians, but I can't say that to a Jew. We need to help each other, especially now because we're cleaning up the language. Oh, goodness, what a job. We need to help each other edit our stuff. So, okay. They're solid involved. They're responsible for the ongoing community. Now, what else is there around besides synagogue that's religious?
Temple.
Who are the folk that go with temple? Pharisees go to temple, but they're not the professionals. They don't run the temple.
The priests.
They're the priests. And what party to the top, to the bishop? Not bishops. See? I need to edit out. What part do the leadership types, and especially the executive leadership types, like high priests, what party do they belong to?
Sadducees,
you got it. Now, Sadducees are a dying breed. Do you know why? What happens to temple? 70 AD, smashed. So there's no more temple. See, well, Jesus is 35-ish. 70 temples down. Okay? So, Sadducees lose power. What else about Sadducees? What's other big about those Sadducee types? See, they're the people that have most, they have more money, they have more social power because they control temple, and temple is big and still big in Jewish society, and kind of the responsibility for the central organization of the religion. What else do are the Sadducees, do you have to know about Sadducees? And it ended up discrediting Sadducees, because nobody that was interested in...
Were they the ones that didn't believe in immortality?
Yeah, they have only the first... They're very conservative. They only honor the first five books of the Pentateuch. So they don't have... They're not as far out as, say, the Pharisees would be on that sort of thing. The other big thing is that these are the... Since they're rich, they're the people that do business with the armies. They're the people that do business with Rome. The deals about how to keep the peace are made between the high priests and the Romans. And if you're part of the folk and you want your own tradition and you want to be independent, you don't like the Sadducees very much. So when Jerusalem falls and there's a decision that they're not gonna be able to be independent, and so they've got to count on lifestyle for autonomy rather than political autonomy for autonomy. The Jews go with the major leadership of the religion passes to the Pharisees. So, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. The big thing that I'm trying to do is, you got to look at Pharisees as really good people. The arguments that Jesus has between with the Pharisees are arguments between two progressive parties. They are not arguments between an outsider. Jesus, for example, look at Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, and you've got a perfectly good rabbinic Pharisaic type Jesus. And the arguments between Jesus and the Pharisees are very, very... there are some Jewish historians who say, hey, that's just the kind of disagreements that went on between the Hillel school and the Shammai school. You know, how many of you have seen The Chosen? You know how they argue about Bible? Mm-hmm. How many of you have read the book of Job? Okay, you know how Job argues with God? I mean... They don't love the Bible by closing down and just sort of making a charm out of it. They love the Bible really actively with their minds by getting involved and arguing about what it means. And so the whole rabbinic process of thinking about the Bible is a way of really using the Bible to fertilize and catalyze and seed stuff. And I just wish we could have a few Jews in Christian Bible study and things would get off the ground in a hurry. And maybe we ought to start doing Bible study with Jews. That would get our juices rolling, and we could get in there and get going on this. Okay, so Pharisees are the party of the future. They're the progressives. They argue a lot, and so I think that the text is saying, when it says the Pharisees, it's like some of us saying the Christians, the people who are making such a big deal that they're the only Pharisees around, and they're maybe the establishment Pharisees. At any rate, this is a good guy. Jesus is going to a good guy's house. And one of my other analogies, you know, if I'm really looking for a close home analogy, I say that their Pharisees are pretty close to Midwestern Lutherans. Solid, progressive, moving the world along. And they are, in fact, the people that preserve Judaism, and because the Pharisees developed a Jewish lifestyle that was faithful to covenant, most Jews did not, never have, and do not, and probably will not see any reason to become Christian. Because the Pharisee reform of the covenant, of the old covenant, really, really was very faithful to a lot of the covenant tradition. A lot of the covenant tradition. And so they have a really strong sense of God leading and guiding and this sort of thing. And so in the ancient world, it was the confused Greeks and Romans who were more open to the Christian covenant than it was the Jews. And that, you know, it's not that they don't know about it, it's just that some of them don't. But it's, so that's a, anyhow, that's another conversation. You know, everything could be a conversation, so make it one if you want it. Anyhow, Pharisees. Oh, remember, so Paul's line in Acts, I'm a Pharisee of the Pharisees. So Paul's a perfectly good Pharisee, never quits being a Pharisee. He just turns from a conservative one into a liberal one, that's all. And he turns from a rabbinic Pharisee into a Christian teacher. And so I may be oversimplification, but more true than most of the simplifications that are floating around. So, okay, Pharisee. Who else is in this? Oh, asked him, okay? Him, that's Jesus. I need to say something about Jesus. I don't know where you're at, because I haven't talked to you that much, but I still get freshmen in freshman Bible from Lutheran churches and assorted other Catholic and Christian churches who have kind of spacey notions of Jesus. Their basic notion of Jesus is of some Greek demigod. Jesus had a divine father and a human mother, and that means that Jesus is half divine. Jesus looks more like Mork. I'm still getting kids that think that, basically think that. Jesus has divine powers, everything that's connected with Jesus. I mean, everything that they don't understand about Jesus is the divine part. But I mean, all of the human connotations of Son of God language, miracles, all of this stuff, all of which is perfectly clear in Hebrew Bible before Jesus and applies to people who are not partly supernatural being. Anyhow, you got this whole theory of supernatural being which plagues our Christology. And if you look at Luke, if you look at the Gospels, it's perfectly clear that we're telling the story of a real human being. The whole point of having a mother is to show that he's not an apparition. He's got full flesh and blood, and okay, so he's born, he dies, really dies, gets put in the grave, and the Christians are quite clear about the fact, it wasn't that he was just in a coma and somebody buried him when he wasn't, he's dead. He gets hungry, he has dinner. Now, nobody would tell you that he went to the bathroom, but he probably went to the bathroom too, and he probably had to, well, it tells you that he needed to wash his feet. I mean, clues, you know, this is a story of a human being. So let's get the church language straight. When the church talks about the oneness of Jesus with God, and when the church talks about the divinity of Christ, we're talking about something that happens to an honest-to-goodness, real human being. We're not talking about a different species. We're talking about something that happens to a human being. That's gospel. The gospel, as most of us have learned it in our tradition, is about God becoming human, not about a divine person playing a human part. There's big fights in early Christianity, and maybe there's some good in some of the other models. You know, I don't want to say that other people's models don't have some good in them. But anyhow, I think the church, at least the church's decision to go with the model that says, hey, Jesus is not an appearance, not the ascetic, but human, is a good one. It's a wise one, a good one, and most of what I understand to be gospel in my life hinges on Jesus being real. And I think in Lutheran tradition, the big thing I think about Christmas Eve in the Lutheran tradition is really that humanness of Jesus. Jesus is a real honest-to-goodness baby. And if you ever have celebrated Christmas in Lutheran tradition, you have ever celebrated Good Friday and see Jesus die by inches, you just know it. You know, it's just in your bones, and whatever you're thinking in your head, you just know that Jesus is a human being. But there are people around now who aren't clear about that, because they've watched so much apocalyptic stuff on television and this sort of thing. So him means honest to goodness, human Jesus. So when we come to talking about Jesus' feet, imagine feet like yours or yours. They're probably bigger than yours. They're probably a bit more. Or you got pretty good sized feet. What size are they?
10.5.
Okay, that's, but I would like to see how, I wonder what size feet Steve has. You know, Steve is the guy who's 6'10". You know, I bet he has huge feet. You know, real feet. You know, so this is a foot story. Let's face it. It's a very concrete, down to earth, if I may make a pun, story about, and, you know, it, so, him. Now notice that Jesus in this story is not even named. And remember how yesterday, on Monday, Jesus was a confronter and an initiator. And notice how yesterday the Christ bearer Peter is an initiator or a cooperator. But notice today that Jesus is relatively passive. Something happens to Jesus. And the whole story hinges on something that somebody else does to Jesus, not something that Jesus does to somebody else. And so that's a kind of flip-flop from Monday. Him. Okay, so we had dinner, and that means something. Remember Jewish kosher rules? We saw them with Peter yesterday. Jewish kosher rules mean that if you eat with somebody, you are acknowledging some closeness with that person. And if you're a minority group like the Jews are and are concerned to be a minority, the whole logic of being a Jew is to be a special people, not to get everybody into being a Jew, but to live a quality of life that is a light to the Gentiles. You observe a lifestyle. You create a covenant lifestyle. And if God wants to make other people Jewish, he can do it. But you don't have to do that. What you have to do is really create the community that reflects the covenant. And this is why it has been important for Jews to have a country, and this is why a lot of what's happening in Israel is not just hard on the Palestinians, it's also tearing the Jews apart. Because they're doing things that are contradictory, that some of them feel are strongly contradictory to what it means to be Jew. And there are other people are saying, we've got to do this in order to remain a Jew, and so you have this conflict in the community that is just terribly under the surface, but it's really, I'm sure, it's absolutely sure it's there. And, okay, so So this is a major, he's seeing Jesus as part of the in-group, part of the fellowship group. This is a major, although he's not a very hospitable host, it is very important that he invites him to his house. He's treating Jesus with respect. He's honoring him as, in some sense, a fellow Jewish male that is honorable. And so Jesus isn't so much of a radical that the guy won't even invite him to his house. He isn't so offbeat and off base in this story that he doesn't get invited to dinner. So he does get invited to Sunday dinner. Okay? We're hardly getting into the action. Sitting at table and a woman of the city. A woman who is a very defined culture. The women's chief sphere is inside the walls. The man's heavy sphere is outside the walls of the home. Lots of powerful women in the family, but a woman who operates in that sphere is not a mother, is not taking care of her family, is used by the men, is professionally a conversationalist, a bed partner, a prostitute, a woman of the city. She's in some sense a professional woman who is living by her wits and having to go it alone, in a sense, apart from her family and her base and her network, and so is in a very special place. And you don't invite her to dinner. You keep her in the city and you keep your wife at home, and you don't invite her to dinner. So she wanders in, and this is kind of a surprise. This is not a everyday how it's supposed to be story. This is a little bit of life, a little snippet of life, just happens, okay? Who was a sinner? A good, typical, male comment. I think if Luke had been a woman, he would not have said this, because it clearly reflects the male, in my book at least, it sounds very much like a male who doesn't want to own that they're really keeping her in business, and doesn't want to own that this woman would not be there if the rules of male society were not such that this was the way that she could make an independent living, and there weren't many other ways that she could do this. And so basic theory, I am, the older I get, the more I think that every time we categorize somebody else, I just went through the men's issues forum and the gay lesbian lecture yesterday. And the more I'm thinking that the more we categorize somebody else, we are projecting on them things that we don't want to know about ourselves. We don't want to know about ourselves. So that when we call this woman a sinner, I have the feeling that men are denying their responsibility for what keeps her in business. And I think if women call her a sinner, I think they're denying that she's a sister. And she really isn't that much different than they are, but she's had a pretty rough set of choices to make. And so be careful with others. There's a funny process going on. Anyhow, woman of the city. I guess that's enough context. What goes on in the story? All right, she happens in. He was sitting at the table. Sitting isn't a very good translation. You don't make sense of the story if you only think sitting, because this is the way we sit. the way you make sense of the story is, imagine a chaise longue, you know, a lot of cushions on the floor. Imagine like those old Roman dinners, and you're sitting here on cushions and the food's here. They put the food down here and you chit-chat with another other person whose the heads are kind of in and the feet are angled out that the servants have to get around. So, you know, feet are right up there big. Feet are right up there big. Bare feet. Why? You took off your sandals when you got to the house. I mean, you didn't truck in those icky, dirty sandals. And everybody wore Birkenstocks. You know, this is none of this. I mean, these are real feet. These are real. We ought to have done this one barefoot. These are real feet because this is, they don't wear, it's hot. You don't wear shoes. I mean, you can lose more heat through your feet and your head. And so if it's a hot country, you have to ventilate the top, or if it gets too hot, then you have to protect it from the sun. But you certainly keep your feet aired out, and they sort of stink, you know, if you walk around in streets that are also partly for sewage disposal and things like that. You've got dirty feet. And if you walk all day, so feet, this is a foot story. So this is a story about real stuff, about everyday ordinary stuff. So along comes this woman, there is feet sticking out, and she has this alabaster flask of ointment with her. She must have thought she was coming. Somebody in the first Bible study, I just hadn't heard this word fully before, and somebody in the first Bible study said, she loses it. She loses it. She didn't come there to weep. She came there to fix his feet. But she loses it. And so her tears wet his feet. And she's got long hair, and she wipes his feet. Kisses his feet. Takes the perfumed ointment and massages the feet. And Jesus, you know, he's sitting next to Simon. He's lying next to Simon, and he can just, you know, you can tell when somebody's thinking something. You can tell when somebody's thinking something. And he knows exactly what Simon's thinking. I mean, just like you can tell what some people are thinking when you do something far out. And Jesus says, Simon, I got something to say. What? A certain creditor had two debtors. One owned 500 and the other 50. When they couldn't pay, he canceled both debts. Now, which of them will love him more? I suppose the one to whom he forgave more. You're right. I entered your house. You didn't give me water for my feet. I mean, you go into lots of, if you're really invited to a first-class dinner, the servants are going to wash your feet, because you got to clean up your feet. You feel better if your feet are washed, just like you wash your hands now. And she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss. It's okay for men to show affection in that society. And men will walk down today in Jerusalem. The Arab men walk down the street holding hands, and the Arab women walk down the street holding hands. But they don't hold hands with each other in public. I mean, they're not gonna do that. But from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, and she has anointed my feet with ointment. I want to stop there, because the rest is important. There's a discussion. some of us may want to have the discussion of why some of us think that the rest of the story sounds more like the Christian congregation doing something with the story rather than sounds like the situation in which Jesus was. One of the things about Jesus, about stories of action which are always put to use, is that they grow a little bit. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Unless a story grows and changes a little bit, it doesn't do what the story is supposed to do. Stories are not supposed to finish everything. They're supposed to start things. They're not the end of your story. They are simply the catalyzing of your story. So don't be surprised if sometimes Christian stories mix with the story that plugs into them and energizes. So anyhow, I want to just stop there so that we have enough time to converse and ask, what are the things in this story that are important for you? What are the things that are the things that I already told you about? One of the things that I get a little bit antsy about, and that's the use of the word sinner. You notice how I turned around and say, "Hey, I'm not. I disagree with the editor of this story, and I wouldn't have called the woman a sinner if I were telling this story without saying it." The so-called sinner, or the woman who was on a marginal, but I wouldn't have called her a sinner. And so, you see, I'm disagreeing some places.
What would you call her?
A marginal.
Mm-hmm.
An exploited woman. She wouldn't make, it's the same old, it's been around a long time. It's been around an awful long time that blame the victim. Half of the problems with not being able to deal with problems is that something happens to a kid, it's the kid's fault. And sometimes it's the kid's fault, and sometimes it ain't the kid's fault. Something happens, somebody gets raped, it's the victim's fault. What do we do? What do we spend half our life doing? You know, same stuff. So we are tuned into some of the dynamics of projection, social projection, although we're not really used to it.
Just two judgmental, two categories.
No, it's not. It's more complicated than that. In other words, we are really seeing I don't know what a new way of looking at it is, but the old way, the old Freudian way, was to call it projection,
mm-hmm.
Which is to. It's not just that it's judgmental in general. Judgmental in general, you can deal with. But when I have a stake in seeing the other person because there's something in my subconscious that I don't want to own, then it's not just judgmental, it's defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just that the church is judgmental, it's that we are defending things that are in us that we don't want to own up to. Just like I think men are homophobic, and I think the whole latching on to gay, lesbian issues has to do with us not being able to come to terms with all the things that we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you wanted to do another one, I think the latching on to the gay, lesbian issue is not owning the violence. That's making it, you know, my lesbian cousin has a wonderful, loving, monogamous relationship, and she's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
What's the real problem is violence.
Mm-hmm.
It's sexual abuse. That's what we're spending our time trying to get out of the closet, trying to how people deal with. It isn't the lifestyle, it's the violence, it's the coercion, it's all the date rape, it's all the incest, it's all the child abuse. That's what needs to be taken care of, and we need to take care of the men who do this stuff without knowing why they do it. And I mean, most of it's done by men. And why in the world do perfectly civilized human beings like men do all this shit? I mean, excuse me, but that's what it is. Do all this hurting of people. You know, and our American cities are terrible. My mother lives in a city, and she won't go out at night.
I don't know. To me, it just kind of, it's all a lack of acceptance, a lack of feeling good about yourself. And that is what's so touching about Jesus, his unconditional love and grace, you know, towards this woman. He just loved her, and he reached out to her. And, you know, he just would forgive her. And he said to the Pharisee, "No, who would you love the most? The man who forgave a little, or who would love the most?" And I think that is what's so touching about Jesus, and that what speaks to me so strongly is how we need to reach out to people on an individual level, and how we need to unconditionally accept them.
This acceptance is really good. The action part, the forgiveness part, is more at the bottom where it's interpreting the action. But the action part is Jesus just lets her do it.
That's the other thing that's sort of interesting, because you really get a different sense of her. If you're thinking of her as, you know, a sort of person that might be, that people might look at someone who's a prostitute as sort of a manipulative person. If you're going to really look at blame the victim sort of approach, and here she is, so really totally exposing herself and her feelings about whatever, we don't know what the history of their relationship was, whether or not she just heard him from a large crowd, or if he spoke to her directly, or what obvious, how he touched her life in some way. But that's, it's sort of in some way really a challenge to what the stereotypes are about a woman like this, that she was willing to come in and talk about. In a way, it must have been really an amazing situation for her to come into this leader's house and sort of for the whole world to see, say, this is somebody that, you know, has really touched me, and I have to find some way to respond.
And she didn't even ask for forgiveness. And so what she does, when you read over the line of what she does, it seems just like an impulsive act of love.
Mm-hmm. She's paying homage, in a way. You know, regardless of what they all thought of her, they may have thought she was a sinner, a bad woman. She felt the need to do this. And if you look at that, what did she think of herself that she felt she had to do this? And she felt some need, she felt she had to make some kind of a gesture there to him, acknowledging his worth. And so she must have felt herself less worthy, and she had to make this gesture.
And it is a kind of devotion. It is. I like your word homage, devotion. And what's so neat about it is that it's something that he needed. There's so many people that are paying homage with stuff that doesn't need to be done, but here is the intuitive sense of he didn't wash his feet. If Simon had been a perfectly good host, she wouldn't have plugged in there. Maybe she wouldn't have even done it if Simon hadn't been just kind of a little bit too proper or too thoughtless. So there is something kind of concrete and very much situational about the fact that she washes his feet and Simon didn't wash the feet. You know, so but it must have been slightly intentional, because she brings in she had the ointment with her. You know? Yeah, that's right. Other things about it.
It's really not clear to me why she came in. I guess that's why I keep asking myself, why did she come to see Jesus? And did she come just to anoint him with oil, or did she plan on, was she really feeling bad about herself and want some forgiveness? We don't hear much about forgiveness in earlier in the gospel yet. Christ is forgiving.
What's your best guess? This is a story. It's okay to guess. Just run with, take the story and run with it. Because the story is to start you off, not to finish you.
My idea is that she's found a great teacher and wanted to be closer to him and find out more about
him. So maybe she just followed him in to just sort of say thanks. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other?
I don't think she was very happy about maybe, you know, where she was in life. And she wouldn't have been leaving. I don't think if she had been, I think she was looking for something else. And she saw him as a light.
It's not too hard for me to understand maybe why she came in. I think it does suggest that there was some kind of, there must have been some other prior contact. And the thing I didn't understand quite from the story is why Simon invited Jesus into his house to begin with. And Jesus came down pretty hard at him at the end of the story. He really kind of, you know, you didn't wash my feet, you didn't do this and that for me. I get the feeling that, you know, the woman coming in and washing his feet was an act of love, was love is action, but Simon inviting him over to the house wasn't an act of love. I get the feeling that Christ knew that maybe Simon was a curiosity seeker and wanted to, you know, I'm not sure why he was invited over, but I get the feeling that Christ didn't see it as a very benevolent act to be invited into his house, and that this was a way to kind of illustrate that.
Yeah, I think Simon is an interesting one to think about. I think that's I got a couple ideas about Simon that we probably should talk about over coffee.